Hello and welcome to episode number 4 of The Music Plays the Band. I'm your host, Rob Koritz of the Dark Star Orchestra. I'm really glad you're joining me today, and I hope you are safe and well. Well, the weather is keeping us off the road until it warms up, and we can start doing the drive-in shows again, which were an absolute blast. And by all accounts, it's probably going to be the new normal for a while. So we're going to have to wait till it warms up to get back out there. But it's obviously tough not being able to work, but the silver lining is all the extra time I'm getting at home with the family. You know, we've never spent this much time at home in 20-plus years I've been in DSO. So we're adjusting and learning how to take advantage of it. Now, one of the positives for me has been the chance to start this podcast. You know, it's been a great opportunity to try something new, stay connected with all of you, and hopefully provide you all with some information and entertainment. For the feature interview today, I am happy to bring along drummer Vinny Amico from Moe. Vinny has been a member of Moe since 1996 and has played his fair share of Grateful Dead music over the years as well. This is the first drummer I've featured, and I'm very excited for some drum talk. Also on the show today is Mark Munzer from the band Playin' Dead to share a little bit about the Grateful Dead scene around the Boston area. Before we get to our first segment, I would like to take a moment and ask you to check out our subscriber site at www.patreon.com/themusicplays and consider a monthly subscription for access to bonus content, including unedited interviews, video features, a look behind the scenes, links to related topics, some cool swag, and other ways to further engage with me and support the podcast. www.patreon.com/themusicplays. Our first segment is the Black Music Moment, brought to you by The Clean Store, brandingandapparel.com for all your branding and apparel needs. Technology-driven solutions and concierge service for managing programs of all sizes. The Black Music Moment is our attempt at chronicling the profound influence of black music and musicians on the Grateful Dead. This week we take a moment to honor legendary bluesman Howlin' Wolf. Born Chester Barnett in Mississippi in 1910, Howlin' Wolf's recording career began at the legendary Sun Records in Memphis. In the early 50s, he moved to Chicago and began recording for Chess Records, and it was here that his career really took off. Many of the tunes he popularized were written by Willie Dixon, who also wrote a lot for Muddy Waters. And quite a few made it into the Grateful Dead's repertoire, including Smokestack Lightning, Spoonful, Wing Dang Doodle, and the one you're going to hear right now, Little Red Rooster. He passed away in 1976, but lives on as one of the most influential bluesmen of all time, and was part of the first class of inductees into the Blues Hall of Fame, as well as being inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1991. So here is the legendary Howlin' Wolf and Little Red Rooster. Oh, that dog began to bark.
Y'all strange can people call Little Red Rooster's on the prowl. If you see my little red rooster, please drive him home. If you see my little red rooster,
you know, Howlin' Wolf is such a giant in the blues and really all of American music that we're going to have to come back in future episodes. And we'll dig into him a little bit more and listen to some of the other tracks that the Grateful Dead performed. Now it's time for the Sarno Music Solutions Breakdown with Brad Sarno. Brought to you by Sarno Music Solutions, producing the finest musical instrument audio gear, designed and hand-built in St. Louis, Missouri since 2003, and Blue Jade Audio, St. Louis's primary audio mastering service since 1999. Brad is a fantastic guitarist in his own right, and this week he's going to share his knowledge of something that I know is near and dear to him, and that's the unmistakable guitar tone of Jerry Garcia. I'm back here today with my friend Brad Sarno. Always a pleasure to have you. How are you today?
Doing well, Rob. Thanks.
Today I'm going to give you a tough one because I know that you could go for hours on this. I've heard you go for hours on it, but we're going to talk about some guitar tones and specifically Jerry's.
how it changed over the years. You know, it definitely evolved. But can you give us your brief description of the evolution of that tone and how we got it?
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, good luck.
Yeah, right. Well, let's see. If we go back to the 60s, I guess you could kind of say he had a kind of a thicker Gibson tone, oftentimes a single coil, but sometimes a humbucker, and big, loud Fender twin amps. And it was just a meaty, rich tone. By about 70, he started to gravitate towards Stratocaster tones, single coil, more country, clear, sparkly, articulate tones. And that became his sound, still with the Fender amps, the loud Fender amps. But the fidelity kept going up, and they started using Macintosh for louder, cleaner power. He started playing more custom-built, high-grade, bright, clear guitars by Doug Irwin. And in the mid later 70s, he dabbled with the Travis Beans, which are also very bright, clear.
Oh, yes, they are.
Almost pedal steely sounding guitars.
Yeah.
And then a couple years, by the end of the 70s, he had these bright Irwin sounding guitars with pickups that he would set to single coil. So it really became a very high fidelity, Fender-y kind of approach. Lots of bell tone clarity and audiophile. Just pristine presence. But being Jerry, he would also just blast the hell out of it and play it the whole rig like a guitar amp and still could get dirty with it. But it had a very distinctly sparkly tone. And I would say by 79-ish, 78 or 79, his tone was pretty much etched in stone. He changed some things, but that was it for the duration for the most part.
I guess the next big thing would have been when he changed and brought in some MIDI in the 90s, would have been really the next big stepping stone in his tone.
Right, right.
You mentioned the amp, and you mentioned the guitar, and you mentioned the speakers. But what about effects? And I know that there had to be some in there. I know you design effect pedals, and some of them are based on some of Jerry's stuff, and some aren't. But it seems like there probably would have been a lot of effect pedals involved as well. Yes? No?
You know, Jerry was a minimalist with pedals. In the early 70s, he used a wah-wah. He discovered the auto-wah in about 76, 77, I guess, the Mutron. And then he wrote a bunch of tunes that are just distinctively Mutron tunes. And then he added distortion, and then he added a phase shifter, and then he added some echo, added an octaver. And so which is still a pretty basic palette of pedals. And he would kick them on, you know, in the appropriate times. But for the most part, the Jerry sound was not a pedal-based thing. It really was a simple guitar to preamp to amp to speaker thing.
That's really interesting because, as you know, and we're going to talk about it in another episode, there's this whole subculture of hobbyists out there who are, you know, home guitar players, if you will. They're striving for the Jerry tone and getting the right axes and the amps and all that. And from what I read, it seems like pedals are a really big deal to them. And maybe sometimes they're a little off the mark with that then. Yes?
Well, I don't know about that. Pedals are fun, and there are some tunes that absolutely call for a certain pedal effect. And so
you mentioned the Mutron before. Name a song that really would have been there in. Can
well,
you?
Estimated Profit, Fire on the Mountain, those really stand out as just distinctively Mutron-y.
Got to have it to get that sound.
Shakedown Street. It's just that bwomp, auto-wah.
Right on.
And it was just the perfect Jerry effect. It just fit his style perfectly.
And, of course, the fingers.
Jerry was – it's about the fingers. What a master. Yes.
Right on, man. Well, I got to tell you, I really appreciate you giving me the short version because – I know how hard that was for you.
so little time.
It's so much to talk about. But right. in all seriousness, thank you for giving some people a little more clarity on that. Maybe we'll get back into that in a little more in depth at another time. But I really enjoy having you on here every week with me, and I'm looking forward to some more in future episodes. So as always, my friend, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
All right, take care.
Today's edition of There Is a Grateful Dead Cover Band in Every Town is brought to you by the Authenticity Academy, offering you online courses and private coaching. If you're feeling stuck or confused about the direction your life is going in, or you've lost touch with your authentic self, the Authenticity Academy is here to help. www.authenticity-academy.com. My guest today is Mark Munzer, who is the keyboard player in the band Playing Dead, who are based in the Boston, Massachusetts area. I've known about this band for a long time, and their rhythm guitarist, Jim Harris, even spent some time on the road with DSO back in the summer of 2000. So let's get right to it. Here is Mark Munzer. All right. Hey, Mark, how are you doing today?
I'm good, Rob. How are you?
I am great. I really want to thank you for taking the time to join me here and tell me a little bit about Playing Dead and the scene around Boston. So the name of the band is Playing Dead. How long have you guys been together? When did you form?
Well, Playing Dead used to be a band called Electric Hummus way back when, and then they eventually changed their name to Playing Dead, and I joined them about 12 years ago.
All right. So and that Electric Hummus, that was the band that Jimmy's in, your rhythm guitar player, who spent a bit of time in the summer of 2000 with me.
That's right. Yeah, Jim Harris has been there since the beginning, and he's still playing with us and Playing Dead.
How often, pre-pandemic anyway, how often would you all be playing?
Well, we all stay local to the Boston area, or New England area, I should say, we all have day jobs and wives and kids, so we typically play about two or three times a month, you know, on the weekends, which is a great way to, you know, continue to keep the music vibes going without it having to be a full-time thing.
Have you been able to play at all during the pandemic?
We have. So we've been fortunate enough to have a few outdoor venues in the New England area that still have live music in a safe way with social distancing. And so we've done, I think we did five shows over the summer, which was pretty good considering.
Yeah, I mean, it's now the weather's getting colder, and probably like us, you're probably pretty much done for the winter, aren't you?
Yeah. We'll kick things back up next spring, and you know, hopefully there'll be a vaccine, and we can start doing things back to normal. But if not, you know, we'll continue to find the outdoor places to play until we can move indoors.
A very familiar story to me as well. Pre-pandemic again, you weren't limited to just Boston. You put all over the Massachusetts area, didn't you?
Oh yeah, I mean, we played also in Rhode Island and in New Hampshire and a little bit in the different New England places, but mostly between Boston and Providence was our and Worcester maybe were our, kind of our three main destinations.
Pretty much all places where you could finish the gig and still drive home.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Keep the expenses down. You personally and as a band, do you all take a specific approach to interpreting the music? You know, and the reason I ask is there's bands out there like us who look at it from a purist's standpoint. There's bands out there who are playing it in instrumental jazz ways. Do you guys have a specific approach, or do you just go out there and go for it?
We definitely take a little bit more of a purist approach. But I have to say, as a keyboard player, I feel like I have a lot more flexibility than Jim and Vic do, sort of playing the Bobby and Jerry roles. You know, with the keyboards, you know, Grateful Dead had, you know, TC and Pigpen and Keith and Brent and Vince and Bruce Hornsby for a while. So, you know, it isn't like I have to play a certain role. So I take a lot more liberties, and there's a lot of stuff that I do that's sort of my own influence. But it's a little bit easier to get away with that on the keyboards, even in a sort of purist type of band, than it would be, you know, for the Jerry or Bobby role.
I got to ask you this, and I hear what you're saying about you having all that freedom, you know, with all the different players, the keyboard players. Is there one that you just take the most from? I don't want to say do you have a favorite, but is there one that inspires you more than the others?
Yeah, well, so my first Dead show was in May of 1980, and so I grew up seeing pretty much mostly the Brent era. You know, I watched a little bit of the Hornsby Vince era, but kind of lost interest as Jerry started deteriorating in the kind of early 90s. So yeah, Brent is really the one that kind of I grew up on. And I just also love his passion and kind of what he put into his approach to playing. So I think I probably channel him the most. Although when I play piano, I usually play a little bit more in the Keith style. Right. I loved Brent's organ playing, but I wasn't always a fan of some of his late 80s piano sounds. So I tend to play a little bit more sort of a traditional acoustic piano when I do play piano.
So you guys have been out there doing it a long time. Tell me a little bit, if you can, about the community in your area. You know, I know you guys travel a little bit around, but I'm sure there are people that you see at every show. Tell me a little about the blah, blah, blah. Excuse me. Tell me a little bit about the Boston Grateful Dead scene.
We have a really great music scene up here in Boston. Some of that is just the quality of musicians from schools like Berkeley and other places, in the New England area that tend to breed, really good quality musicians. We have quite a few bands that all play, different, like you said, different styles of Grateful Dead tributes. And we have a really, really encouraging audience that, just loves to be able to come out every weekend and be able to see some form of, whether it's Grateful Dead or other, original improvisational music. And they're incredibly supportive. I know they all go to your shows when you come to town as well. So they love DSO. But they love the ability to, really get their live music fix every week by coming to see us and other local Dead bands.
What is it about this music that's creating this, do you think?
I mean, to me, the Grateful Dead were just so unique in so many different ways. They were one of the first bands to take the approach of playing different songs at every show and having one song be 7 minutes one night and 12 minutes another night. And so it enabled fans to want to go see show after show after show because they weren't going to see the same thing. You take that and you combine it with, great original songs, incredible lyrics by Robert Hunter that still resonate with everybody. And then you mix all the styles that they played, from blues to folk to country to rock to jazz to funk. And it's just something that's unique, and really nobody's been able to duplicate it. There are plenty of jam bands that, had followed the formula of playing different songs at every show and all that, but there's just something very unique about the Dead and the chemistry of the members of the Dead that, to me, make this music timeless.
Isn't that a beautiful thing, man?
It is
so beautiful. Well, hey, man, I really appreciate you taking time. For those of you, nobody knows this, but it's Sunday morning, and the fact that you're taking time out of your Sunday morning to do this with me, I really appreciate it. I hope we get back up there. It's always nice to see you when we come up and play in the Boston area. We get to have dinner together occasionally. Hopefully we will get back to those days soon, pal.
I agree. My pleasure, Rob, and great to talk to you.
All right, thank you. That's Mark Munzer from Playing Dead.
If you like what you are hearing today, please head over to our subscriber site at www.patreon.com/themusicplays and consider a monthly subscription for access to bonus content, a look behind the scenes, links to related topics, and a bunch of other different ways to further engage with me and support the podcast. We have a few different levels to choose from and some really good things to offer, so please check it out, www.patreon.com/themusicplays. I am so excited for today's interview because it's the first time I have featured a drummer, and that drummer is Vinny Amico from Mo. I had a lot of fun with this one, and it was great to kind of geek out a little bit and talk drums for a while. So here you go. I hope you enjoy it. All right. Hey, Vinny, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
How's it going, Rob?
It's going okay. We're hanging in there.
Right.
You're in New York, correct?
I am.
And what are you doing to keep yourself busy during all this?
Well, I have a few lessons I give. I have done some side work because of where I am in upstate New York. And through the summer where it kind of mellowed out a lot over here, I was working in Vermont a lot, which they're... they were really diligent about, doing stuff safely. So, Zach Nugent, right?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, so Zach, and I were doing a bunch of gigs up near Burlington and stuff. So
they are totally vigilant up there. We did one gig at the Burlington Fairgrounds, or maybe two gigs. I don't remember, but you couldn't walk into the hotel
right, without basically taking a test at the door. And that's right. why they have zero cases.
Right.
You know?
Right. So, you know, I did that. And between that and the lessons, and I practice more than I ever have before, which I never have been a practicer, and it's kind of boring to play drums by yourself, but you know, but my fundamentals were never very good. So I'm getting much better fundamentally as a drummer, and certain things that I always could do, but couldn't do well, are starting to fall into place, because it's like, oh, right. If I had just, you know, done the rudiments instead of like bastardizing everything, right. Now I could just do it because, oh, right, that's how your hands are supposed to go if you practice.
I need to take a page out of your book, because I'm the same way. I'm not big on playing by myself. I don't get a whole lot of joy out of it, and I'm not practicing nearly enough as I should.
Now, granted, I am not, you know, pulling off any of the crap like the Instagram guys or any of that. I get my pad out. Or I'll pad up my kit because I don't want it to be loud. And I just work the rudiments around the kit.
Yeah.
I work the rudiment sheet. I work rudiments, and that's it. Because it's like, oh, this is the stuff that, you know.
How long?
I know why people can do that, you know.
How long can you last when you're practicing by yourself? For me, it's maybe 15, 20, if I'm on a good day, 30 minutes. Then I'm just
bored. I'm about 20 minutes is about my tolerance. And now, yesterday I went about 40, and I didn't even know it because I was getting into some cool stuff. And
that's a good sign.
And I'm like, I just did 40 minutes of, you know, of stuff.
So now you're practicing now, which is great. When did you start playing?
I was 10, so I'm 51. So I've been playing for 41 years, almost my whole life. So
this is spooky. I'm 52, and I started when I was 8. So we're now. Did you start with lessons, or did you just start banging on stuff?
No, I started with lessons in grade school. You know, snare drum and rudiments and that. And I played 2 years, and I was in band and stuff, which I didn't really love. And I skipped a couple of concerts to play baseball. I was a good pitcher. So, and then I got kicked out of band, or I got screamed at by my band guy when I, you know, skipped a concert. So I kind of, you know, I didn't have great feelings about all that. And then they stopped giving you school lessons like in seventh grade. My mom wasn't going to pay for it anymore.
Right.
So that's when I started, but I had a kit and I was playing all the time, you know, because I enjoyed it. So that's when I went to self-learning. And, you know, if you have good time, and you can groove, you start playing in bands and you start actually getting calls because you actually can play the drums. Like there's tons of guys that can, or they used to be anyway, that there was tons of kids that, oh, I'm a drummer and I do, you know, and they're in band and stuff and they go to play with a band and they suck. They can't keep a beat, you know? So the guy that can actually keep a beat and make it easy for the rest of the band always gets the work. And that was me.
Remember those words, folks. That's very important. You're the first drummer I've had on as a feature interview, so it's great to get to geek out a little bit on it. You started about the same time I did with the Rudiment book. Do you remember what your first book was?
I had the Ludwig. It was like a greenish, lightish green. I think I still have it. I could look it up. It's like something for snare drum.
Gotcha. Mine was the Haskell Haar snare drum method.
That might be it. Wait, I'm going to go downstairs into my drum room. And
books 1 and 2, they're right on the shelf over there. I still have them.
Yeah, I haven't looked at them, but I do go, like, I get into stick control all the time. I still go back and work those pages because you can never work stick control enough, honestly.
I took out those books one time a couple months ago just to see what I was doing in 1978 and play them again like when I was a little kid. It was a lot of fun.
I got drum student, snare and bass drum, musical studies for intermediate, so that must have been my sixth grade. Breeze Easy method for drums, I think that was Easy 1 and 2. I think those were my first two. Oh, and then the Ludwig collection of drum solos. So those were like my first 4 or 5 books.
I have most of those on the shelf over there. I'm looking at them right now. do you remember when – so you started playing drums at 10 – do you remember when you first heard the Grateful Dead?
I probably had to be like when I was 12 or 13. You know, I had a paper route and I would have my Walkman, my Sony Walkman in. And sometimes I would listen to the music to the radio instead of tapes.
You had the fancy one that had the radio and the cassette player.
Yeah. Wow. So, well, it was an off-brand though, but I put it on, and I always thought that the Grateful Dead was like a heavy metal band because of the name.
Right.
And then, you know, like, Casey Jones comes on, or A Friend of the Devil, and I'm like, this is the Grateful Dead. You know,
this isn't heavy metal at all.
This isn't heavy metal at all. And then where I grew up, in Niskayuna, in the Capital District, where you have 10 million concert venues within a couple hours, and the Grateful Dead used to tour this area 3 times a year. So you could catch no more than 15 Dead shows without ever driving more than an hour and a half.
Right.
So by the time I was 14, 15, either I was going or my friends were already going to see the Dead, because I live near SPAC, and the Dead played there every year since 1980.
Right.
So my first show was 1985, which was, I was 15, but had already been listening at that point.
What was it that grabbed you, man? What drew you into it?
Well, it was my friends. And they were already going. They were already into it. So I went to that first show, and I was like, that was amazing. And then the next night was Hershey Park, which I was about 2 inches from going to. I didn't end up going. But after that, we all started really getting into it at 15. And then I joined a band of my friends, and that's the music they were playing. You know, so I started learning the catalog and jumping into, you know, this is 1985.
Right.
So think of all the bootleg tapes that I was getting and listening to. The shit was just amazing. Like,
right.
It's like a big, huge band playing freaking freeform jazz all the time, you know, except for around that songbook. So it was like, you know, most of the shit was just amazing. So
when you guys started playing it, were you trying to jam like that as well? Or were you just kind of playing the songs at first?
No, we always went right to jamming, you know. And we were also, because we were into the scene, so we were taking drugs and shit. So we'd all, you know, take acid and then go down in the basement and play for 6 hours.
That's so awesome.
Around those songs. So we started to like, oh, get it. Like, minds open, kind of leave the song behind, although you weren't. You were actually getting deeper into the song with the help of, you know, some of that psychedelics. And it, you know, it transformed my playing at the time. And I got into, you know, when I went to college, I joined a Dead band, and we were one of the premier bands in Western New York for years.
What was it
and
called?
And we played Sonic Garden. And we played, you know, we studied the music, and we played the music.
I'll tell you what, doing what you were doing and really starting to jam out on it and take it out from the song form in high school or in your late teens or whatever,
yeah,
That's heady stuff, man. There's not a lot of cats that could really do that. And, you know, and
right.
That's a huge learning process, pulling it off at that age.
And what, like, informed my playing and, you know, opened me up. Now, granted, my father was a jazz musician. I had been around bebop, you know, hard bop since I was little.
What instrument did he play?
Trumpet and flugelhorn. So I had been aware of, you know, improvised music and that groove and that feel and the openness but even, you know, in that genre there was still form, but everything opens up. So like I was able to catch the connection with the Grateful Dead and bebop jazz really early on, in how there's a song structure, yet when you get to the solo or when you get to certain parts, that's when it opens up. And to me, it was very it was very similar to me. It wasn't like, oh, this is this and this is that. It's all like, oh, this is it.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So like I was exposed early on, and it just tied in with that.
Because of that, since you already have kind of that jazz background a little bit and the bebop thing, are you, at that point, are you more attracted to Billy's drumming than Mickey's because it's a little more jazzier of a style?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, I was always the Bill guy kind of anyway, because he was more of the time guy.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I was a time guy, you know. So, but even early on, so by the time I'm a senior in high school, I'm in a Dead band with a second drummer who was about 15 years older. He was an older dude. you know, we're doing parties and popping acid and playing for 6 hours, and like, and playing well for the most part. I mean, if I listen back, I'd probably be like, ooh, but I'd also be like, wow, there was some cool shit in there, you know?
That's a big thing too. Cause there's been times, you know, not just my playing, but I'll go to a Dead show.
Yeah.
And for whatever mind altering reason, think that was the greatest show ever.
Yeah.
And then you go back and listen to it and you're just like, holy shit, that was not very good.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
And I'm being nice when I say it that way.
Yeah. You know, yeah.
Cause there's times when I've done it and gone back, holy shit, I enjoyed this. This sucks.
Yeah. Yeah. This is horrible. Yeah.
I want to get a little drum geeky about it. Yeah. Playing style, you know, you said you're in those formative years, you know, that really changed your playing style or your approach.
Yeah.
Can you be specific?
Well, I mean, like you're being your age, right? Same age.
Right.
Most of the drumming I learned, cause I would sit there with records. I wouldn't play to records. I'd air drum the records and memorize everything and then go play it later to my drum set, which probably also helped my brain to get through songs and memorize and all that stuff.
Right.
But it was, you know, it was Led Zeppelin, it was Van Halen, it was Rush.
All so the heavy stuff.
And that stuff is nothing like the Dead. So I come into that music with this sort of style of playing the drums. And then you're like, oh, this isn't like that at all. You know, this is completely different. You could transform the Bonham stuff into the Grateful Dead a lot easier than, say, Neil Peart.
For sure.
Or, you know, Alex Van Halen or a lot of these guys. But, I mean, we grew up in classic rock times. So, you know, those weren't the only things. Those were like the eighth and ninth grade. But then you get into Yes, which, you know, Bruford's a freaking jazz drummer.
Right.
You get into Genesis, which when you got the double drums and Chester Thompson, who was a freaking monster, you know, you were able to, you know, and listening to some of the fusion stuff that you get into, the Jean-Luc Ponty's and the Jeff Beck stuff, that like you're exposed to a lot of good sort of open sort of music. So a lot of that is able to transfer to the Dead stuff.
Right.
You know, song wise, those songs are so strong that that's kind of where you, kind of connect to. It's like, oh, these songs are great, you know, and then you're able to put all that influence out in those songs.
Does that
make sense to you?
Me as a drummer, it completely makes sense. Yeah. Hopefully to all you non-drummers out there, it also makes sense.
Right.
Are there, you know, you mentioned the songs, are there particular songs or just eras even that you really got off on more than others? Are you going to say the one drummer stuff?
No. Song-wise, there's a lot of them. There's too many. I actually love the 80s Dead.
Me too.
I am a big fan of the 80s Dead. And, you know, I saw the most shows for me. I saw about probably 45 or 50 shows between 85 and 93.
Yeah.
Most of them were 87 and 91, which I probably saw like 35 of them.
That was my career as well. Yeah.
And that was the best of the Grateful Dead, even to those guys, you know.
Yeah.
That was the best years of the Dead. Not the greatest shows ever. Consistently night to night to night to night was the best.
Right.
So, and that's the stuff I really love and I'm connected to.
You know, it's interesting that you say that because I find, you know, with everybody in my band, it seems like, and I'm with you, you know, the 80s is really what hooked me in when I first saw them, and
yeah,
Mickey playing these giant tribal fills across the bar line that I just thought was the coolest stuff ever. But everybody in my band, it seems their favorite era is when they started seeing the Dead.
Right.
You know, so the older guys, it's, you know, 72. Jeff and Skip and those guys, you know, are over 60 years old now.
Right.
You know, and they're seeing them in 71 and 72, you know, at Fillmore East and stuff like
right.
that. And
right.
That's their favorite stuff. You know, I started seeing them in the 80s.
Yeah.
That's my favorite. Lisa started seeing them in the late 70s. That's her favorite. Also, because Donna was there. But I find that when I talk to people, a lot of times their favorite is where they started.
Sure.
You know, and I've learned to enjoy all of it, but that's really what got me off at the beginning.
Now, that being said, the first like live thing that really blew my mind that I studied was one from the vault, the Great American Music Hall 75.
and they're playing so much difficult stuff on that album,
oh
too.
Oh, my God. It's so good. It's like a jazz album almost,
yeah,
you know?
It is.
It's like, so.
And that's right when Mickey's just coming back.
Right.
You know,
right.
So he hasn't even been there for a while, and it's on fire right from the beginning.
Oh, my God. It's killer. And the songs are just freaking crazy.
All that crazy cowbell in King Solomon's Marbles.
Oh, I know. It's so great.
And that's actually one of the hardest ones for us to play. And me personally, that's definitely the hardest song to play just because all the cowbell.
Right. Yeah, I've been playing it with Marcus Rizak and the Shred Is Dead stuff. No cowbell because of
one drummer
stuff. Right. But I'm just – it's pretty interesting to improvise over seven too, like with as being one drummer. And and he shreds a little more, so it kind of takes more of a, you know, it's a different animal. It's just it's song and form only almost, you know, because it gets a little different. So
tell me a little bit about that project you just mentioned, because I know you're about to maybe possibly go do some gigs.
It's you know, I've always been a purist dead guy. So when I go to see a band that's playing that music, or, you know, at this point, even Dead and Company, it's like, if it doesn't sound like Jerry Dead, I'm always like, you know, or like I'm never like as super into it. But with this, it's like, if you take it for what it is, and it's like taking those songs and then kind of playing them more like a shreddy band, it's kind of fun. And there's a lot of improv going on, because, you know, it's in form and melody, of course,
right.
But you really can take, and Marcus is a really good guitar player and he shreds some of that shit. So once he starts putting some of the runs that he puts in, you're just like, holy shit. And you go with it, you know, and it's a lot of fun.
Is it a 4-piece?
Usually it's four piece.
And so it's only one guitar, and then the other four, the fourth player is a keyboard.
Yep.
So that's leaving everybody, especially the guitar player, so much more space to shred like that.
Right, right. And then the bass player gets to kind of, you know, fill in spaces. But he hasn't gotten a fill type of guy. You know, he's got usually a groove type of bass.
No, I saw a video, man. I can't remember what song it was. You guys were playing outside. I just watched it.
Oh, yeah. I was in Vermont. Yeah.
He's a funkmeister, man.
Yeah. Oh, that was Chris DeAngelis from Kung Fu.
So that's a different bass player than you're using on the next stuff.
Yeah, gotcha. I was bringing my guy from Rochester, Rolf Witt, who played in Sonic Garden with me. He's a great bass player. So, and he actually took the time to learn a bunch of the songs. He's playing in a band out in Buffalo area called Wild Nights. That they're, you know, they're like 40-year-old dead band. Yeah, they play the shit better than most.
What are they called? So,
the Wild Knights.
I'm going to have to get some info and maybe talk to them for my cover band section.
Yeah. So, we've gotten back together. We just did a gig in, when was it? August, September. It was half of the Sonic Garden guys and half the Wild Knights guys who were kind of together at the same time in Buffalo. So we kind of were melding bands together. So we played, and we hadn't played together in 25 years. And we did a gig, and it was the best Grateful Dead band I had played in years. It was freaking killer, because when you know the songs for 40 years and you've been playing them for 40 years,
right?
And you know them the way the Dead plays, you know, like the music just plays you. You know, you're just there, you know, and it's I don't know how else to explain it. You get on stage, and within a song, it's like, oh my God, I'm in the Grateful Dead right now. And you're just, you know.
That is why this podcast is called The Music Plays the Band.
Yeah. Like you stop, you're not playing, nope. You're not playing the music, it's playing you for sure.
And that's my all-time favorite Grateful Dead lyric.
Yeah.
And probably, you know, when I get interviewed and people say, what's your favorite song to play and all that, which is a horrible question.
Yeah.
If I have to answer it,
yep.
My answer is usually the music never stopped.
Yeah.
Partially because of those lyrics, partially because it's got a great groove, but then it switches to a 6/8 thing.
Yeah.
You know, it really covers everything about the Grateful Dead in one song.
And that's the beauty. I mean, with you playing in your band and how good you guys do it, every night must be totally enjoyable. Like you just get on stage and then you're not playing anymore. You're just at a Grateful Dead show, like grooving, except for the fact is you're making the music.
Yeah.
You know? You know, and you get to put your touches on it, so it's not necessarily sounding exactly like them. You know, there's things you would do differently than Mickey or Billy. You know,
100%.
you know.
I mean, there's some things that I would totally do differently that I can't.
Like, right.
I'm a big, me personally, my playing style prior to this, I'm a big fan of splash cymbals.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I grew up on Stuart Copeland, and then and I really got into Carter Beauford when Dave Matthews came. I can't I can't really put splash cymbals on my kit.
Yeah, right.
You know, they
right.
just they don't fit. So Mo started in 89 and you came along in 96, is that right?
Correct. Yep.
When you came in, did you already know those guys?
Yeah. Yeah, I had I was working in Sonic Garden, but I had it was a couple bands I was playing in Buffalo at the time. That were like a house band at Broadway Joe's. So all those guys used to come there. So they all, we all knew each other from school and from the scene.
Were they all, are any of them any Dead fans already? Were they into the Dead as well?
Al had seen, you know, a lot of shows at that point. So he was into the Dead and influenced by the Dead. The rest of the guys weren't very into it. And Jim, who was the second drummer, who, he and I were friends before there was ever a Mo or anything. He came to college. My roommate in college was his neighbor. So when he came up to visit UB, he came and stayed with us and instantly got pulled into our scene. Not the Sonic Garden Dead scene, but just my hang, you know? So, and was not a Deadhead. He still isn't. He doesn't really like the Grateful Dead. But so Al was the only one that was into that stuff at the time. But we all knew each other from the scene. And Topper, who used to be Mo's manager, and I lived together. So
gotcha.
Yeah, it was pretty incestual.
So with Al is the only true Deadhead or Dead fan in the band, besides you, of course. Do you think, and from what I can gather, you guys have done like 15 studio albums from what I saw, somewhere around there, and then a bunch more live albums as well. But do you think, and the answer may be no from what you just told me with the background, you think the Grateful Dead has influenced the band's songwriting in any way?
Absolutely.
Yeah?
Absolutely. You know, more so from Al, but if you listen to Rob's song, you know, it's all over in there, you know. Then probably subconsciously in a lot of ways.
As I said, because Rob's not a Dead fan?
No. So,
but you think it kind of by osmosis or somehow creeps into the songwriting?
Yeah, I mean, he's a big Little Feat fan. Well, then. Like, you know, so Lowell actually produced a Dead record, you know, and so there's like, there's a whole, you know, there's, and everybody, you know, is a band fan and everybody likes Bob Dylan, you know, so it's like, there's just influences that are undeniable.
A lot of cross-contamination. You
know? Exactly. Exactly. So that is exactly true. And if you listen to the live stuff, our jams are very Grateful Dead-like in their their form. Almost, right. You know, how we get from song to song. And it's not conscious. It's definitely not conscious, but it's just kind of a byproduct of what we're trying to do.
Right. Right. You mentioned Jim a few minutes ago. Jim plays percussion. You play drum set.
Yep.
In the Grateful Dead is drum set. In Mo, it's drum set percussion.
Right.
How do you approach that? And you already answered, Jim's not a big Dead fan.
Right.
So I don't know, for you anyway, does the double drumming of the Dead have any influence on your mindset? And also, is it different when you're double drumming with a drummer or a percussionist?
Yes.
There you go, folks. Thank you, Vinny. We'll talk to you later.
Yeah, no, it's all of the above. Like, you know, like there's definitely a way to play double drums that is different than playing with a percussionist, especially if you have studied how to play double drums. And by studied, I mean, listen to the Grateful Dead and the Allman Brothers.
Right.
You know, like listening to as much Grateful Dead and playing as much as I have with another drummer, like you have, you know how to play with another drummer.
Right. Period.
That's different than playing with a percussion player, but only in, you know, how you play your notes or, you know, where you play stuff. You're still staying out of the way of the other guy.
Right.
you know. So like, and I used to play in a group called the Outer Circle Orchestra, which was a world beat band. We played, you know, everything from salsa and merengue to some of the, you know, a bunch of the 6/8 African stuff. And so you learn how to stay out of the way and play with percussionists. We had three percussionists. You learn exactly what to, you know, so I kind of mix the two, playing like the Grateful Dead, but playing more in a, what would be like an Afro-Cuban sort of styled band when I do the most stuff, because it's different. You know, you become a percussion player and not just a drummer in that, because you might be playing the shaker part on your hi-hat and just playing four on the floor, which right. I do a lot in Mo, you know? So it's like, you know, you become, you know, part of the percussion ensemble and not necessarily a drummer.
Right.
So, which kind of, you know, is Mickey and Billy in a lot of ways. They're not really playing your, you know, what you would consider a normal style of no. drumming. I mean, it's like,
definitely
it's just
not.
A big freight train going down the freaking...
On a good night, it's a freight train, and on a bad night, the guy in the New York Times called it sneakers in a dryer.
Yeah, exactly. And there's both, you know.
There is definitely both. It happens with me and Dino. I mean, there's nights that will come off and it's just not good.
Yeah, yeah.
Or there's nights we'll come off after the drums section and go, that was awesome. Or
yeah.
Nights we'll come off apologizing to each other for screwing it up, you know.
Just, yeah. That's, or stepping on each other in some way that you didn't mean to, yeah.
It's just part of the improv thing, you know, when nothing's planned. But like you said, if you've studied it, it works. And I think back to – I'm pretty sure it was in the State Theater in Falls Church when you came out and played with us one night.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And you and I had never double drummed together before.
Right.
But we sat down and had no problem right from the beginning.
Mm-hmm. I think right from this – yeah.
Tennessee Jed maybe? I can't remember for sure.
I think we did that, and then I came back on for one more Saturday night at the end. I remember that.
Right, and, you know, so. But nobody had to worry because we've all done it before.
Yeah.
Right. Sometimes Jim, though, he plays a lot of mallets with you guys, right? He plays a lot of vibes and marimba.
More and more, yeah. As the years have gone on, he's gone more to that, which then puts me in a, you know, that's a melody instrument to me. So it's more like playing piano. So then I can play more like a drummer in those situations.
Right.
And not like, I mean, more like a one drum, you know, like, right. Like I'm the only drummer. And then it helps me because he and I have played so long together that I can do his runs with him. He's playing a melody now and I'm on drums and we can match up and, you know, back, you know, I can back him up very well when he's on those instruments.
Right. So. Right. That's awesome. You know, that's exactly what I was thinking when I asked you about it.
Yeah.
Let's geek out for a minute, man. Let's talk about equipment. If we bore you out there, folks, sorry.
Too freaking bad.
That's right. You know, being such a fan of the Dead and the drummers, was there any point, I mean, I know the answer for me is a resounding yes, where their equipment influenced how you were going to set up or how you were going to play or how you tuned them or your cymbal choices?
Well, not the cymbals so much, but I played Yamaha drums for years. Yeah. Because they, you know, like, I think Billy got his, that black Yamaha in what, 87? Mm-hmm. And Mickey was playing the Remo. And then right. They both, by 88, I think they were both on Yamaha. And that's, I got a Yamaha. It was red.
There you go.
Like a dark red. And, you know, and I played Yamahas until I went to Mapex in like 2012 or 13 or something.
Those are great drums.
So
I have a Mapex kit at home. My practice kit is a little Mapex kit that I love.
Yeah.
And
so
black cat. And
I
went to,
I mean, I switched over because the Yamaha stuff was getting, it was expensive. Not that you buy drums that often, but I was looking to upgrade and I just, it was like, whoa. And I was a endorsee. So I, you know, I was paying half of what retail was.
And they're still expensive.
You know, or even more. And I was like, wow. And I had a friend that had recently gone to Mapex. And, I mean, working there. So I knew I had people that I, you know, like having personal connections to a particular company is important to me. Like just, you know, not being a number or just an endorsee, like actually knowing people that I can work with and
for sure
them being friends and not just, you know, a business associate was important. So, and he was into it, you know, he said these drums are amazing. So I went over and the drums are amazing. You know, they're, They're very modern sounding, which is, you know, good for modern music.
Right.
Yet some of their, I mean, the Armory kits, they're the midline ones.
Right.
Freaking are vintage sounding, and they sound great, and they're cheap.
I will say this, though, and I've got that kit here, and I've got a Pearl kit here at home, and my drums on the road are GMS, but...
Oh, yeah, right.
Yamaha hardware, man, for all of it.
Oh, yeah. I have Mapex for my stuff on the road, but I... My home kit, which is a Mapex that I use a lot because I do a lot of side work, is all Yamaha stuff.
It's the most versatile hardware in the world, I think.
It fits the best. I mean,
yeah,
it's the strongest. It doesn't break.
Was there anything like, you know, Billy was an influence, and especially 80s Billy and 90s Billy, his drums are just dead as hell. You know, they got all that tape on them.
Yeah.
Did you go for a dead sound because of him or anything like that, or you let him sing?
Early on, not with Mo, no. I'm wide open. Although right. I'm starting to focus him a little more. But I've been wide open with Mo for years. But now I listen to some of the tapes and I'm like, I wish more was coming through the PA. And right. I think it's because they're so open that they take a little less in the PA.
They might even gate them, who knows?
Yeah. So now I'm starting to put a little tape, moon gel on the bigger on the floor toms, but still trying to keep them somewhat open.
Right.
So
one of the big things, and I'm going to talk about myself for a minute, but one of the big things drumming wise that really influenced me, and you'll love it too, being an 80s guy, was for me, one of the things I love is when Mickey moved that big tom, which should have been like his last rack tom or his first floor tom.
Right.
Put it over in the number one spot where the smallest one would be. It would like double the snare drum.
Yeah.
On two and four with the tom sound. That's one of my favorites because that there's the freight train definition right there. You know?
So when I play when I play as a single drummer with a Grateful Dead band, I play on all those songs that you hear that, which is a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
I play my floor tom and my snare drum together.
Yeah.
Almost everything.
It's the best.
On everything, you know. I mean, that makes total sense because when you watch him play and then playing with two drummers and playing dead stuff, when you go to that part, depending on what the other drummer's playing, if you go to the tom parts, it totally makes sense on sticking and how he plays and what it sounds like and how melodic it becomes. Because the reality is that Mickey Hart is actually approaching the drum set more like a percussion rig. You know, so he's almost playing like it's, you know, like he's playing a conga rig or, you know, in his, you know, some sort of, he's always been a world music guy. So some sort of bastardized version of all, you know, all forms of percussion from all over the world.
Yeah.
So, and that's kind of how I think he approaches it and how why he sets it up the way he does, why he plays the way he does.
It's much easier to have it over there for sure. Cause you know, it's hard to cross your body.
Yeah.
Or you have to move your right hand from the hi-hat to the floor tom or cross your left hand across your body to get to the floor tom. So it makes a lot of sense.
Right.
And it's a whole lot of fun to play that way. Another thing I loved was later on he got the talking drum that was on a pedal.
Oh, yeah.
So you didn't have – could you play it with two hands and use your foot to change the tone of it?
Oh, is that why it's like – that's for especially for the drum solo stuff?
Yeah. And that one was like – even in the 90s he had it on – like where the last rack tom would be.
Oh, right. So then he could play with two hands in that one.
And you know, without having to like squeeze it between his legs. Like during a drum solos, him and Billy might put it between their legs.
Right.
And squeeze it that way, which is a whole lot of work.
Right.
Like the thigh master for drummers.
right. And then, so back to gear for cymbals, I recently, right before COVID, changed to Zildjian. I was a Peisty guy for my whole professional career.
Really?
Yeah. And then, you know, I would listen back to stuff and they occupied so much space, the Peisties in the mix, because they're loud. They take up a lot of space. And I switched over to Ks. I have all Ks now and, you know, they're quieter. And
everything your crashes are Ks too?
Yeah. Everything I got is K. So, and they occupy less soundscape on stage. And there's a lot of tones, like, you know, the Peisty stuff as consistent as it is and how good it sounds. Like if you break a cymbal, you just can order another one. It's going to sound exactly the same.
Right.
There's a sound across the Pisces, which is kind of consistent as well with the Zildjians. Like you, it's all over the place. You know, everything sounds different.
Right. So. I've been a Zildjian guy since day one, never played anything, but
yeah, I was a big Bonham fan. So, you know, and the Pisces crashes in particular always sounded best to me. So
I don't know why I got into, I mean, just when I bought my first kit, my big Neil Peart, lots of concert toms kit in 1981, you know, the kit, you had it.
Oh yeah.
I bought it with Zildjian cymbals and just became a fan. You know, in fact, one of the ride cymbals I use on the road, my main ride cymbal on the road, is a 20-inch medium that I bought with my very first drum kit in 1981.
That's awesome.
It's probably been hit a billion times, you know?
Yeah.
And it's got that, it's got a sweet spot in it. I always have it tilted where I got that sweet spot, and there's a sweet spot on the bell that I'm always going to be on.
That's awesome.
And I use A's mostly. I have a couple of K crashes, and then some KZ, the KZ hi-hat combination.
Right. Yeah, which is a very popular situation, but it sounds so, it's so tight and quick. Yeah.
And, nice. And that's like a big sound, you know, is the dead late 80s and 90s.
Yeah.
And the hi-hats became a lot more prevalent in the mix.
That way, that open hi-hat all the time.
Yeah.
That Mickey thing.
Yeah, exactly. And the ones I have a set of those here at home that I use, and the ones I have on the road that we use were actually Mickey's.
Oh, no shit.
And they have a date on them when they came into play on 7/2/88, which is Oxford Plains, which is a great show.
Oh, yeah. I saw them right before that in Rochester. And in Buffalo.
That's a good run of shows right there.
Yeah.
So those cymbals came in then, you know, somebody wrote on the inside of the bell, the date on them. And we got those and a bunch of other Mickey and Billy cymbals. We bought them at an auction years ago.
Nice.
So those, I mean, that is the sound. I have the sound for that stuff, man.
Yeah.
My main hats on the road for all the other shows we do are those and the ride cymbal are the 14-inch new beats that I got with my first drum kit in 81.
Yep.
And they're green and they're beat to hell, but they sound so good.
Yeah, and don't ever clean them.
Hell no.
Fuck them up.
Yeah, people, don't ever clean your cymbals. Don't you take all that dirt out of the grooves, you're taking away the character.
Yeah. I used to clean the Pisces because the Pisces are just a crisp, you know, shiny.
Yeah.
And they sound that they're kind of made to sound, you know, clean. But I'll never touch the K's. Plus, they don't come clean anyway.
Right.
When like, I was, you put that shit on there, and it's like all the fingerprints are still there.
That's when I was a kid, you know, in high school still, I would clean these cymbals. And with that Zildjian cymbal cleaner, that really creamy white stuff.
Yeah.
And all you would do is ruin a bunch of towels because it gets so dirty.
Right. And then your sticks would get all black.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, what the fuck?
This is not the right move. It's just getting dirty.
Yeah.
Man, I cannot thank you enough for being here. But before I let you go, we're just going to, if you don't mind, we're going to do a quick lightning round. Don't think, just answer.
Yeah.
Can you handle that?
I can handle it.
All right, here we go. First show.
SPAC 85. You mean dead show, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Favorite show?
SPAC 85.
Studio recordings or live recordings?
Studio.
All right, man. I like it. Favorite Dead album then. We'll move to that.
Terrapin or Shakedown.
Favorite non-Dead album?
Fuck, dude.
I know. This one I love to put everybody on the spot with this one.
I can't name one. I got five.
Name two of them.
Steely Dan, Royal Scam, Paul Simon, Rhythm of the Saints.
There, oh man. The Paul Simon concert in Central Park from 91, right after that one came out.
Yeah.
Is my Desert Island album.
That band is freaking,
oh my God,
killer.
Five percussionists and and the Brazilian percussion ensemble for the beginning.
Yeah.
And Steve Gadd.
Yep.
And Armand Sabaleco on bass. It's just, oh my God. It's just, and Richard T on keyboard. It never ends, man. It's just so good.
I know. That record's fucking amazing.
Oh, it's so good. And I know we've gone off the lightning round, but here in town every once in a while, but pre-COVID anyway, I play with this group and we'll go out and we'll do all those songs. We'll play the Paul Simon stuff with the full horn section and two percussionists. And oh my God, is it fun?
Right. Oh, but if we get into the Bob Marley thing, then all his live stuff. That band, again, the Wailers is just fucking ridiculous. Yeah. Live band.
Favorite color?
Blue.
Blue. First job?
First job, I was a landscaper. Well, delivering papers. I was a paper boy, but then I landscaped. Not a real job, right? Just no, job.
Paper boy. Yeah. That would work. That's the first time you got paid to do something, right?
12 years old, yeah.
Favorite venue to play?
Another one that's just nearly impossible to answer. The Tabernacle.
We were supposed to play there for the first time back in April.
Yeah. I mean, vibe-wise, it's just freaking amazing. But, you know, when you play Radio City, play SPAC, you play Red Rock, like, it's impossible. But yeah, consistently, that place you go in. Or you know what the other one is? Roseland Ballroom, which doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, we played there once.
Yeah, I probably should have said that over the Tab, but we haven't played there in a long time because it hasn't been a venue. So
I'm actually looking at a picture on the wall right now of us at the Roseland that was on the cover of Polestar.
Yeah, is that not one of the freaking most energized, amazing rooms ever?
Yeah, and that was like the biggest crowd we ever had in New York City, at least at that point.
Yeah, 4,000 people.
Yeah, it was screaming, nuts,
or 3,800, whatever it is.
Well, I was really excited to play the Tabernacle in March. We were finally going to get there in April. It was Masters week. I know it was going to be in April.
Oh, so, man.
And I was supposed to go to the Masters, so fuck COVID.
Did you just watch it?
Yeah, I did this weekend. It was great.
Yeah, DJ just crushed.
He was so consistent. Oh, best city for a day off?
New York.
New York. First car?
Was a Oldsmobile, what was it called?
The four-door?
Yeah, it was, my mom gave it to, it was
the 98?
No, it was a smaller one. It was the, it was an Oldsmobile or a it was a Pontiac, yeah, it was that Oldsmobile, the mid-size one.
Something by GM.
Hey, Deb. What was that car my mom gave me, the purple one, my first car? What was it called? Oh, no, was it? Was it a 6000? Maybe it was a Pontiac 6000.
Are you getting help from your parents on this right now?
My wife.
Oh, that's too funny. That's too funny. Current car?
BMW 328 iX.
What book are you reading right now?
I'm not.
You're not the first person who has said that. That's all right.
I might have to take reading a book.
You know, this is a musician's thing. I might have to scratch that question from the lightning round because I've gotten I'm not reading a book.
I could. The last book I read was the Van Halen thing by the tour manager.
Yeah,
it stopped and that was a fucking killer book. Learned a lot about Van Halen in that book.
First, magazine. You have any magazine subscriptions?
Not currently. I do Relics. I mean, that's just a, we got like as part of the band, I think we got like a prescription forever.
Man, first of all, I love having a drummer on. It's great to get to talk drums.
No doubt. I could stay on for another 2 hours talking, believe me.
So. Hell, man. I remember one night we sat in that place in Amsterdam up above that party, that grilled cheese party after the show, talking about snare drums for an hour.
Oh, I know. Up in across the street from the milk bag there.
Up in
that was
top.
A good party.
It was. Sexy grilled cheese party. And we talked about snare drums all night. So I love talking drums, and I really, really appreciate you taking the time to spend it with me today and share some of your insight.
I appreciate you having me. And like I said, I can do it for a long time. So if you ever need another guest, I'll do it again. Different stuff.
For sure, man.
We could get into some of the other drum paths we've gotten on that have led us to where we are today. So
I am all over that, pal.
So
all right, buddy. Stay safe, stay well, and good luck with everything.
Thanks, brother.
Thank you, bud.
Yeah, talk to you later.
That's Vinny Amico from Mo.
Cheers.
That was a lot of fun. I hope you all enjoyed that. Well, that brings us to the end of our episode. I would like to thank Vinny Amico and Mark Munzer for taking the time to be here. And I'd also like to thank my sponsors, Sarno Music Solutions and Blue Jade Audio, The Clean Store, and the Authenticity Academy for all of their support. The opening and segue music you're hearing are remixes of portions of DSO drums segments that are produced by my drumming partner Dino English. He's doing some pretty cool stuff with the remixes, and I think he's going to be releasing an album of it very soon. We'll make sure to let you all know about it. The Music Plays the Band is produced by myself and the production and songwriting team Brothers Lazaroff here in St. Louis, Missouri.
You can find out more about them at www.brotherslazaroff.com. I'd like to make one last reminder to head over to www.patreon.com/themusicplays and become a subscriber to the Music Plays the Band podcast. We have a few different subscription levels and a lot of fun things going on as companion content to each episode. I will be back again in 2 weeks with episode number 5, featuring Ben Kaufman of the Yonder Mountain String Band. Until then, stay safe, stay healthy, and please, please, stay vigilant. We need to get live music back out there as quickly as possible, and we need everyone's help in making that happen. Thanks for being here. People joining hand in hand while the music plays the band. Louis Vuitton setting us on fire. Crazy rooster crowing midnight.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.